You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Gemma Tarlak is back with us now for our monthly look at intriguing stories from the world of science. This month, forget the birds and the bees and meet the beetles instead, plus the science of sleep and a hidden treasure trove of scientific artifacts that could be at risk. Gemma Tarlak is the senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello, and happy science to you, my friend.
And to you. And I want to start with an issue, a very sad start to an issue that is maybe opening people's eyes to a risk out there. This fire at this museum in Brazil. First, remind us what happened, real sad story.
Yeah, a local time in Rio de Janeiro on September 3rd, I believe it was, in the evening, this fire broke out at the National Museum of Brazil. And, you know, it's not just the National Museum of Brazil. It is one of the largest and most important museum collections in the world. Just to put it in perspective, we think of, you know, the British Museum, home of the Rosetta Stone and many, many other important objects as kind of a premier world museum. Well, the Brazil's National Museum had twice as many items in its collection. So it's twice as big as the British Museum. And a lot of these items were just absolutely irreplaceable and precious. Entire histories of indigenous cultures and ethnographies, dinosaur specimens that don't exist anywhere else on the planet, the oldest human found in South America, all of these irreplaceable objects were in this museum, and the fire was catastrophic. They're still, of course, going through, figuring out what was lost, but it seems what I've heard from researchers, our estimates are 85 to 95% of the items are gone completely. Devastating and tragic. And unfortunately, many people are saying it's early days, the investigation is ongoing, but many people are saying this could have been prevented with realistic funding for the museum, for safety measures and other things that could have stopped this tragedy.
And then you wrote about a wider issue this illuminates on your blog, Dead Things. There's a lot of stuff, and I don't really see the scope of this. When we go to a museum, we're kind of seeing the tip of the iceberg. There are these huge collections in storage or basements or whatever. A lot of objects in museums, treasure troves really, that we don't see and even researchers aren't seeing.
Absolutely. And, you know, what's really interesting, as the fire was still smoldering, quite literally, this paper came out that had obviously been prepared for publication months before, but this paper came out from a consortium of museums in California. And what they did was address the problem of what they call dark data. And when you look at especially, say, paleontology, let's focus there for a while, but other scientific fields are very similar. When you look at the information that a researcher can access, it's generally what's been published, generally in a peer-reviewed journal. And that is, like you said, just the tip of the iceberg of what is actually sitting on museum shelves. A lot of times items are collected and they're just, you know, collected in a huge pile, say, of shell fragments from seashells that are a couple of million years old, say, and they're just basically put in a museum back room until someone has time to go through them, and that takes years or decades, or it never even happens. So this consortium in California, these museums got together, and they looked at a very specific part of their paleontology collections, and those were marine invertebrates that were 0 to 66 million years old. So basically, marine invertebrates since the dinosaurs went extinct. And they looked at all of the information that had never been cataloged, never been published in a peer-reviewed journal, not accessible to anyone who's not actually in that dark room in the basement of the museum, and they figured out that there is about 23 times the data that we have available to us through published things. So in other words, if you have X amount of data on marine invertebrates already available and accessible for researchers to look at in a database, there's 23 times that sitting on museum shelves that has not yet been studied, published, and entered into an online database.
So one possible partial solution to both that problem, this dark data, and to the risk of losing stuff forever in a fire like we saw in Brazil, an idea that, hey, maybe we can catalog this, digitize it, have some kind of online electronic presence of all this stuff that scholars around the world could look at.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, just today, in fact, I was reading the University of Texas. They have a terrific indigenous languages collection. And after the museum fire in Brazil, they called an emergency meeting, and they decided to dedicate themselves to digitizing their entire collection, getting it online, getting it basically out of the dark back rooms of the museum, and making sure that, you know, unfortunately, if the worst, if the unthinkable happens to the original material, they'll have it in a digitized form, you know, basically preserved forever. And I think we're going to see more and more collections wanting to do that, more and more museums looking at Brazil as a horrible example of what can happen if you don't digitize your material. Two things on that. You know, digitizing is not free. You can make the interns work for free, I guess, make them work long hours, but in all seriousness, it is not free. It requires resources, and that means it requires the will not only of the actual researchers, but of the museums and the funders of the museums. So it's going to take a lot of money to get that work done. And the other thing, too, you know, paleontologists I talked to about the Brazil fire, all of them mentioned, yeah, digitizing is great, getting an online database is great, but you know, it's really not going to replace the actual fossils, because there's a lot of information that you just can't get from a digitized record. We're now able to look at fossils on such a tiny microscopic, micro-microscopic level that they're able to see things like blood cells and, you know, the shapes of the proteins in them, and so they're able to get down to such a teeny tiny level in a fossil that it's not really logistical to do all that for every single fossil, logistically feasible to do all that for every single fossil and digitize it. So we will always need the fossils. We will always need, you know, the actual objects. But digitizing and getting things online is one way to at least have some of the information saved.
Let's now switch gears, Gemma, and zoom in on one particular fossil. Again, you wrote about this on your blog, this 99-million-year-old beetle trapped in amber. Tell us why this beetle was exciting.
Yeah, well, if you've seen the picture, and I encourage you to go online and look at the picture, he's just, you know, he looks like he's waving hello with one of his little antennae. It's gorgeous, the state of preservation. And what's really cool is what was preserved with him. When you look at the piece of amber, you see to one side of the beetle, all these, they look like teeny, 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 tiny coffee beans, but they're not. They're actually pollen grains. And this incredible find, again, about 99 million years old, appears to be the oldest insect that was pollinating a very specific kind of plant called a cycad. And cycads, they have been on this planet for almost ever. They predate the dinosaurs. There are still a few species with us today. And researchers have always been puzzled about how the early cycads were actually pollinated, because it's not through wind. You know, a lot of plants are pollinated by wind. And it's not through flowers, because cycads were gymnosperms. They did not flower. So researchers were wondering, how did these really early plants that have been around forever, how were they pollinated? And they think this beetle is providing the answer, because they found it with these specific cycad pollen grains that were so well preserved they could actually identify the genus of the pollen grains. And then they started taking a really close look at this beetle, and they realized it has all these adaptations, like these hollow areas filled with bristles in its mouth parts and things. They think this beetle was adapted to pollinate that plant. So that would make it the oldest such example. And also solving a mystery of, hey, how did those early cycads get pollinated anyway?
It sounds so specific. Like, I imagine some scientist out there a couple years ago thinking, we could solve this mystery if only we could find a perfectly preserved beetle with the exact kind of pollen in enough detail that we could identify both of them by species. And they got it. Merry Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. It made some paleobotanists' day, I tell you that.
So, and amber is pretty cool stuff. Like, a lot of stuff gets trapped in amber, and this is a lot of what we know about insects and other stuff from way back when.
Absolutely. And you know, I think we may have talked about it a couple months ago, but earlier this year they found this fantastic baby snake, also from Myanmar or Burma, from the north of the country where all these spectacular amber finds are coming from. And they could actually tell, this is the oldest snake in the fossil record and the only baby snake in the fossil record, but they could also tell by what was preserved with it, the pollen grains and the tiny bugs preserved in that same piece of amber, that it would have lived in a rainforest environment. So, you know, you just can't get that kind of detailed and incredibly broad information from, you know, if you find a bone in the desert. That's, you know, that's great, and trust me, that's wonderful. But when you find the actual piece of amber, it often preserves like an entire sliver of the ecosystem. So it's, yeah, there's more and more amber finds coming out, and it's absolutely fascinating to see them.
We're going to tweet, by the way, a picture of the photogenic beetle. So quickly follow us on Twitter at Central Time WPR. Let's do a little lightning round, Jem. There's two more things I wanted to talk about. One, the science of sleep. And my question or the topic I want to bring up is, you know, we all hopefully sleep like humans. It's a thing we do. We still don't know exactly why we sleep, why we dream, right? This is still, there's still a lot of unanswered questions.
Exactly, and it's kind of crazy when you think about it. It's something we spend about a third of our lives doing. And no one is sure why we sleep, why animals in general tend to sleep. A couple of them don't. They're, you know, 24/7 types, whatever. But, yeah, why do we sleep? What do we get out of it? And what's interesting, I think a lot of people, you know, they've heard of REM, rapid eye movement. They know that's the phase of sleep that involves dreams. And I think a lot of people think, oh, only really advanced animals do that, like humans. And maybe if you have a dog, you've seen your dog's eyes twitching and its paws, you know, kind of running as in a dream. But the fact is, the latest research suggests that REM, this, you know, deep dream time sleep, actually may be an extremely primitive adaptation that may go back more than 500 million years to the very earliest animals.
All right, some fun facts about sleep there. And our last topic, we'll let the Princess Bride set up for us.
All right. Where is the poison? The battle of wits has begun. It ends when you decide and we both drink and find out who is right and who is dead.
All right, so our topic here is poison, and you, being Gemma, did a 20 Things We Didn't Know for Discover Magazine all about poison. Why poison, Gemma?
Well, I think it's interesting, and I also think it's something that people kind of throw the term around, but maybe they don't really understand. A lot of people I know use the terms like poison and venom interchangeably, and they're not. So, plus, you know, it's a lot of cool facts, a lot of things. For example, the poison dart frogs everyone talks about from South America, especially in Peru. Everyone thinks, oh, they're just these, you know, horrible creatures, they're venomous, whatever. And no, actually, the only reason the frogs have poison is because they eat beetles that produce batrachotoxin. So the frogs themselves are not poisonous, and they're certainly not venomous. It's just what they eat. What they eat happens to be producing a poison or producing a toxin, technically.
And give us the difference, poison, toxin, venom.
Okay, super quick. Poisons are any substance that can cause harm, including death. So it could be, for example, lead or certain pesticides, or even, you know, people have pointed out water can be poisonous if you drink too much of it. Toxins, though, they're usually defined as poisons that are produced by living organisms. And it's usually as a means of defense, to give you an edge in the mating market, you know, or even to subdue prey. And then you have venoms, and those are toxins, which are injected or you know, forced into another organism, usually by stinging or biting.
All right. We'll sort those out next time we're considering the world of poison. Gemma, thanks so much.
Hey,
it's always
remember,
fun.
Every rose has its thorn.
Gemma Charlak is the senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She'll be back with us next month for more stories from the science world.